Okay. So Natasha asked me to discuss a little bit the problems of to know up to which velocity do the 1D rotating stellar models consistent. Actually, by consistent, I mean that the hypothesis that we are doing and the numerical procedure that we are using are consistent between them. It does not mean that they are true, that they are the reality, but at least that they are consistent. This is the point. I will try to divide my presentation in four parts, but I don't know if I will have time to go through all of them. I will just to recall first an approximation that is made in 1D rotating models, which is a Roche approximation for computing the gravitational potential. I would like to use then to discuss a little bit up to which point, to which omega over omega crit we can go with 1D rotating models. I would like to say a few words about chemical mixing, because for me it's a key effect of rotation. If there is one, it is a chemical mixing which is important, not so much hydrostatic one. And finally, there will be some, just briefly mention some effects of fast rotation at the surface of the stars, on the mass loss rates, for instance. And maybe I will give the floor to Stan for that part. And also I will give the floor to Catherine Lufkin about 2D stellar models with rotation. So, of course, when you have a star which is rotating, the first obvious point that it will occur, it will deform the star. And if it is deformed, we can wonder, but how can we handle this with a 1D model? And actually, we can do it in the following way. But let me first say a few words about the Roche approximation. So, of course, in order to know how much a star is deformed, you need to compute the hydrostatic equation, which says that the pressure gradient has to be equal to rho, and here you have the effective gravity, where the effective gravity is, of course, the combination of the classical gravity and the centrifugal force. If we make a very simple drawing where we have the radius in both axes, we suppose that the star is rotating along this axis. You have a kind of surface. Let us suppose that the star is rotating like a solid body. In case the star is rotating like a solid body, you can derive the force from a potential. You have what we call a conservative case. So you have here the center of the star, of course. At a given point along this surface, you have a radius which will depend on theta. This is the collatitude theta. And you will have actually a gravity, the classical gravity, which is along the radius, which is directed toward the center of mass of the system. And you will have a more or less big centrifugal acceleration force whose amplitude will scale as omega square r sinus theta. This is the norm of these forces. Of course, you can decompose it in two directions, the direction er and the direction e theta. And for this, you have to make a projection. You can find the theta angle here again, because. And so you will have along ER a component which will be omega square or sinus square theta, because you have the sinus of the angle multiplied by this. And during E theta, you have omega square or sinus theta cosinus theta. So you can see that the effective gravity will be the composition of these two vectors. So it will be something like this, you see, gf here. And there is a small angle, epsilon, here, which is a little bit of discrepancy between the radial direction and the effective gravity. Typically, if we take a star which is rotating at critical limit, which is, of course, a very fast rotation. And we make the Roche approximation. I will come in a while on what is the Roche approximation. We have that this angle epsilon is 13 degrees at theta equal 45 degrees. So it gives you an idea on the deformation in case of the Roche approximation. This angle, epsilon, decreases very fast when you decrease the rotation. Typically, epsilon vary as omega squared. So it means that if you divide omega by a factor 2, you will divide this angle by a factor 4. It means that it will be about 2 degrees for half the limit. Okay. Now, in case of this kind of solid body rotation, I take this as an example. You could take also this kind of other conservative case where omega is constant on cylinder. But I take the solid body rotation, which is more, I would say, appealing for what happens maybe in nature. You can write that the pressure gradient, P, is equal to rho minus a gradient of a function, which is a potential. And this potential contains actually the gravitational potential plus a potential from which the centrifugal acceleration can be deduced. And it can be written as minus g mr over r minus 1/2 r squared omega squared sin squared theta. And you can see that if you take the gradient along the radial direction, for instance, you will have the gravity, normal gravity. And here, this is a Roche approximation. So you suppose that most of the mass is not deformed by rotation, and most of the mass maintain or keeps a spherical distribution. Of course, this is not true, because we know that the star will be deformed by rotation. But in many cases, as we will see in a while, the star will be deformed mainly in the outer layers of the star, in its outer layers, where the mass is small. So probably it's not so bad, I would say. And if you take here, for instance, the gradient along the radial direction, you will have the two, which will cancel here, r omega squared sin squared theta, and you will find these components of the centrifugal acceleration. And you can do the same when you do the gradient along the e theta direction. So in the case of solid body rotation, you have a load to write this equation, and you can deduce the gravity and the centrifugal acceleration from a potential. So the surface, where C is equal to constant, typically it can be written as GMR, R, I drop the minus sign, plus one half R squared, omega squared, sin squared, theta equal to constant, which can be the mass, where here we have the radius of the pole, because at the pole, the sin theta becomes zero. So you have this kind of equation, which gives you how r and theta are related. So it gives you the deformation of the star. You have to put in this equation, of course, the mass. You have to put an omega that you can choose. This is the parameters. Of course, you have to put a radius at the pole. And this you don't know a priori. But you have to either you have to go through the whole process of computing the stellar structure equation, accounting for the centrifugal acceleration, to have this rp. But this rp is not so much dependent on rotation. Actually, if we make models and we change the rotation, the radius of the pole does not vary so much. And I can give you a little bit of here. But it's less at the critical limit. Rp can change by 5%. But if you look at omega over omega crit below 0.5, it's less than a few, 1-2%. So you can put here the radius of a star which is not rotating, and you can compute the shape of the equipotential. And if you do that, you obtain something like this. We can put here omega over omega crit. So this is 0, this is 1. And you shall put here the radius of the equator divided by the radius of the pole. Of course, at 0, it's 1. Actually, when you are at the critical limit, it's 1.5. And the curves is something like this. It's very, very flat, but it becomes very steep at the end. Actually, if we make a small table, if we have omega over omega crit, we have Re divided by R pole, here, the equatorial radius divided by the polar one, we can put 0.5, 0.7, 0.85. 0.5, this is 1.05. So at 50% of the critical limit, the radius of the equator is 5% larger than the pole. 0.7 is 10%, and 0.85 is 20%. Very often, okay, this is what gives the Roche model.
Is that for a particular kind of star?
Actually, it depends a little bit on the mass, it's right. But you see, it will not be so much dependent. So it's more or less for any kind of stars.
Okay. It's not a great approximation for planets.
No.
They have a different hole.
No, it's not absolutely. But of course, this is for stars.
Well, the Roche approximation is not very
good. No, I mean, just those numbers aren't quite right.
Do you plan to rotate at the critical?
I mean, for those fractions of omega over omega crit, you'll get a different RE over RP.
Because
they're less centrally condensed. So
that's just a process in the Roche model. It's not anything intrinsic to planets. It's just the Roche model not working.
I think it's because they have a different structure, and the model is worse.
I think that's the same statement.
Yeah.
Okay. So, just a few words about this ratio, omega over omega crit. So, omega over omega crit can be written as, let us omega crit. Let us compute omega crit, which is the square root of g, the mass, if we look at the surface, divided by the radius at the equator when the star is rotating at the critical limit to the cube. What I want to mention here is that, of course, in order to compute this critical velocity, you need to know the radius of the star at the equator when it is rotating at the critical limit. And this is not obvious to have it without making a model, I would say. Of course, you can do a trick here. You can say it's more or less equal to Jm Aec cube. You divide by R at the pole at the critical limit to the cube, and you multiply by R to the pole at the critical limit. And this is equal to the radius of the pole divided by the radius of the equator to the cube, yes, multiplied by Gm, radius of the pole critical at the cube. And this is more or less equal to 2/3 to the cube. And this quantity here, you can take it nearly as the radius of the star, which is not rotating in some way. So it's a way to compute the critical limit from a non-rotating star. So you would have here something which is, yes, okay. It has, so you will have 2/3 at the power 3/2 multiplied by Gm a cube Pc. Very often, this quantity, if we take a star which is not rotating and we compute, we put here the radius of the star, we have what we call the Keplerian velocity. The Keplerian velocity is actually the velocity at which the centrifugal acceleration would balance the gravity, but without changing the shape of the star. So the Keplerian velocity is not the critical limit. It's only the critical limit when the star is rotating at the critical limit, I would say. So this would be a kind of what we call the omega, because we are speaking here omega Keplerian. Another point which is worth to mention is that V over V crit can be written as omega over omega crit at the power 1/3 multiplied by 2F minus 1 at the power 1/3, where F is the ratio between the equatorial and the polar radius. So, of course, there is, if we look at the general shape, you have, again, here, omega over omega crit. You have here V over V crit, 0, 0. And this is, of course, similar, 1, 1. This is similar. But of course, it's not a straight line like this. You have something like this, you see? So the V over V crit is smaller than omega over omega crit. And you can just give a few numbers here. You have omega over omega crit and V over V crit. Typically, for 0.3, 0.6, V over V crit would be 0.2, 0.4.
When you say V crit, you mean the
omega
the equator when you're at critical rotation?
Absolutely.
Okay, because there's another important quantity, which is the ratio of V over V orbit for each size for the particular star that you're interested in.
Okay.
And that will make a difference in how easy it is to get materials ejected into an orbit.
I see.
And there's a very nice summary of all these points in a paper in this review on the E stars by Thomas Rubinius.
Thomas, okay, thank you. Of course, a point which is maybe to underline here is that when you are at the critical limit, it does not mean that the matter will flow away, actually. Jupiter is orbiting the Sun at the critical velocity. It simply has an orbit where the gravity is balanced by the centrifugal acceleration, but Jupiter is not going away, you see. Actually, you are in a place where if you push, it's easy to push it because you have the balance between the two. But it does not mean that it will go away.
One of the reasons why I think it's much better to use the language critical rotation rather than breakup.
Breakup, yes. It's why, actually, I learned from this from you, and now I use only critical. So thanks. Okay. So now, of course, this show... Yes,
maybe I'm wrong, but if you have a V over P crit as one third of omega over omega crit, your curve should be the other way around. That's more X curve than...
No, it's like this.
Like this?
Yes. F is... No, it's like this.
Ah, okay.
I'm sure of that. Okay. So the point is, the first question, in order to go to the second point, there are two points. First of all, here we speak about solid body rotating models. What happens if we don't have solid body rotating models? And the second point is, let us make maybe a further, let us suppose that the stars are rotating a solid body. How good is a Roche approximation? Actually, if you look at a solid body rotating model, and I would say that typically when you include the telluspoid dynamo into a model, you obtain such a solid body rotating models for most of the main sequence stars. So it is one possible case, I would say. Of course, it happens that during the evolution of the main sequence, the core is contracting, so it's rotating faster, and the envelope is expanding, is rotating slower. And if you impose solid body rotation by a strong coupling due to the magnetic field, for instance, what you will do, you will slow down the core and you will accelerate the envelope. So you have a transport or angular momentum from the core to the envelope. And it happens, sorry, yes?
So could it be that, could you have a situation where if the core and the envelope are rotating at different rates, but the envelope is more or less solid body by itself? The envelope is more or less solid body by itself,
okay,
but at a different rate than the core, that the Roche approximation might work well for the envelope, even if it doesn't work well for the core, if most
yes.
of the mass is in the core.
Actually, I will come a little bit to that point in a while. But it happened, you see, that this transport of angular momentum from the core to the envelope can if you start from a high enough initial velocity, this kind of situation can bring you to the critical limit at a given point during the main sequence. So you will have a situation where we have omega, which is flat inside the star, and omega over omega c is 1 at the surface. So this is clearly a point where you have the strongest effect of deformation and where maybe the Roche approximation is not valid. But you have to remind that the critical limit varies as more or less the square root of the density. This is m over r cubed. And the density increases a lot when you go inside the star. So if you have omega over omega c equal 1 at the surface, omega c will increase a lot when you go toward the center, while omega in a solid body rotating model will keep constant. Actually, it happens in those models where the critical limit is reached at the surface. I have not checked this one because from real stellar models, but my guess is that most of the mass will be far away from the critical limit. So I would say that probably the Roche approximation, at least for this situation where you reach the surface critical limit at a given point, are relatively safe, in my view. Now I would like to come to the case of non-solid body rotating models. Actually, in non-solid body rotating models, the things are complicated by the fact that
Can I ask you something before that?
Yes.
Related. How do you, when you do it compared to observations of rapidly rotating stars, let's say Alpha Leonis, right, where you can really see the distortions in mappage.
Like Arcanar, it's Arcanar?
Arcanar is another one.
Another one. Okay.
No better.
I see. Okay.
But when you try to plot it, for example, in the HR diagram, and then try to compare it to single cellar models, and it doesn't obviously work.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what would you do?
Okay. Of course.
So there we know the mass and we know.
Wait, can you say what's the funny thing about this star again?
It's very rapidly rotating. It's distortion. The equatorial temperature is a few thousand Kelvin less than the pole, and it's all mapped. You can image it.
Okay.
So you know that. You
know that it's distorted.
Yes.
You know that it's gravity dark.
Oh.
And you know it's gravity dark.
Mm-hmm. And you know it's gravity dark. Mm-hmm.
Of course, I don't know the specific case that you mentioned.
Well, in general,
but in general, you see, one of the difficulties when we go to fast rotating stars is that, of course, the position in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram will depend, of course, on the mass of the stars, on its age, but also on the efficiency of the rotational mixing, which can change the structure of the star and make it brighter if it puts helium at the surface. In addition, the deformation of the star, if it is strong enough, can make the star to have different brightness if you are at the equator with respect to the pole.
You know the inclination as well.
You know the.
But what number do you put on the diagram then?
Yeah, that's my question. What to do? How do you actually do the comparison to the stellar model? I mean,
this
I can calculate, of course, the surface flux. That gives me a luminosity, so that I know.
I would put it on the HRD based on the inferred polar. You use the luminosity in the inferred polar radius.
Mm-hmm.
To define a...
But this is a good point indeed.
Yeah,
actually, of course, probably both the luminosity and the effective temperature are affected. Because I don't know... But of course, if you know the inclination, you can compute the total luminosity. So you know.
So given the definition of effective temperature, don't you just have to pick a radius for which the volume of the...
Well, you can, if you know the total surface. Yeah,
okay.
You can show
it
in effective temperature then.
Why do you want to put it on an HR diagram?
Because I want to compare it to stellar models.
You forget about HR diagrams and you just run some evolutionary tracks with the appropriate information from rotating.
Putting in the HR diagram, evolutionary tracks. That's what I mean by comparison.
Yes.
Yeah, but so you can always define a radius for which the surface area of the equivalent sphere is equal to the surface area of the whole star.
Right.
And then you can always...
Yes. That's exactly what people do.
Okay. Absolutely.
And it doesn't lie anywhere where it should lie.
Okay.
Okay, so maybe just can I little bit reformulate it? So if you will look on an observed sample of rotating stars, and if you will try to compare it to revolutionary tracks, at which critical velocity you cannot match anymore?
You cannot match anymore.
You cannot match, right? So somewhere you can match. Where is the border?
Actually,
I think one should still be able to match in my case, right? Because.
Okay. Actually, I have not looked at that.
Yes, sure.
So that's why I said, where's the border on the omega?
Of course, what of the difficulty when we speak about this case is that you have some other parameters like the overshooting, which can change a little bit the luminosity at a given age. So it's not only rotation, which can make some blurring of the position in the Hertzsprung diagram. Since I don't know precisely that case...
We should have a discussion of this,
okay.
Because I thought you had perhaps already thought about it.
Actually, we have thought, of course. In general, when we put the tracks in the Hertzsprung diagram, we do, as you mentioned, you put a kind of mean effective temperature average over the surface of the star. We have made some computation where we looked at the effect of the angle. Actually, you have a population synthesis tool which is called cyclist, which account for inclination, for the limb darkening and the gravity darkening effect. And so you can see how a tract will change depending on the inclination angle. But we have not made actually this kind of exercise up to now, I would say.
There's an important distinction here between rotation is a physical process that affects stellar evolution and whether our models can reproduce that and at what part our models are just false. But also rotation just as something that affects the surface appearance of stars. And these are two separate issues. The Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is designed to represent stars that are spherically symmetric and have a single effective temperature. And as a tool, there's no surprise that it can't model rotating stars that have a whole spread of effective temperatures across the surface. So basically, the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is no longer a uniquely valuable tool for rapidly rotating stars, irrespective of how rotation affects their structure and evolution. It's just the fact that they no longer have a uniform surface temperature and they're no longer spherical. And therefore, the assumptions on which the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is based are no longer valid. Well,
strictly speaking, the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram has an effective temperature and a luminosity.
Yeah. Well, strictly speaking, it has a colour and an apparent magnitude.
I'm talking about theoretically. Exactly. Let's not confuse things.
So would it make sense, for example, instead of representing stars as points on the NGR diagram, to represent them as, you know, like short line segments or curves?
Yeah. So Paul, I've got a 2004 paper with Stan and Thomas Ravinius that does just this. It shows near critical stars at different inclinations, and you can see the spread in the positions of the stars.
Typically,
as they go along, they could maybe widen or shrink.
So if the star is polon, as you spin it up, it appears to increase in luminosity at constant effective temperature. When it's equatoron, it appears to redden at constant luminosity.
Just to give you an example, because this is the point that I wanted to speak at the end, but I can just give a hint on that. If you have, it is for, I think it's for, I don't remember exactly, it's for 20 solar mass, or yes, I think it's 20 solar mass star, but I don't remember exactly. But if you put a track, this would be the track with an inclination of 45 degrees, let us say. Actually, here, the luminosity, which is put here, is not the bolometric, the true bolometric luminosity. It would be the luminosity that you would infer if you see only one hemisphere of the star and you infer the total luminosity. But it's not the true bolometric luminosity here. If you look at the star in the equator, it will look fainter and a little bit redder. And so the track will be something like this, I would say. So here it was 90 degrees. And of course, you have this situation in case E equals zero. And if we take omega over omega crit is equal 0.70 for the initial rotation, you would have here a difference of 0.15 dex. So a difference of a factor 1.4 in luminosity. And if you compute the extreme between the effective temperature, it's about a factor, I would say, 0.025 dex. So it's much less. It's a factor 1.06. So just a difference of 6%. But it gives a little bit of a difference. Yes?
Yes, I'm surprised that because I thought this effect would be very large, and we thought about stars in intermediate age clusters. And so maybe I didn't do this well, but I tried to integrate over a Roche lobe surface. But the fact the diagram you have there is your star is barely deformed unless your omega over omega crit is basically in the 90% regime.
I would say above 0.70%.
Yeah, 0.7, but the real big deformation comes at the end, right?
Yes, so absolutely.
Is it 0.7 in that diagram?
0.7 would mean 1.2, it would be here.
So even if you're that deformed, most of the lights, whatever angle you look at, is almost always the intermediate regions because the equator gets dark and the pole doesn't have much surface. So I found much smaller effects at this.
Much smaller? Or?
Well, I don't remember the numbers, but I'm surprised how big they are.
Okay, actually, I hope that we didn't.
The pole and the equator is indeed very large, but most of the light comes from intermediate latitudes.
I agree, yes. This is true, I agree. But at least, I think that it was done right. I hope so. I took it from a paper that we published, actually. If we made something wrong, I will. But this is
70%, it's initially, right? So
it's initially. Of course, this is decreasing, of course. You see, this is just the initial velocity, and you're right. Actually, the effect will decrease when the star is expanding. So at that point, for instance, omega over omega crit, depending, of course, on the mass loss rate, on the mass, probably it's below that value, you see. Because here we account for also, yes, we account for the change of the rotation during its evolution.
The stars evolve towards omega, omega, but grid towards one, right? If they're co-contracts with them?
No, no. When you have expansion, actually, of course, it depends on
what you did with internal angular momentum transport. Okay, this internal, is without magnetic
field. Exactly. Okay. This is without magnetic field, actually, this is cellular rotation. So you approach the critical limit, but in a slower way, I would say. And I, unfortunately, I don't remember, I should have noted here, I don't remember the initial mass of that star. So I can look in the publication. It's a publication by Georgi et al., 2014. And it is where the cyclist population synthesis tool is presented.
How much more luminous will this be at the end of an main sequence than a single star?
Sorry?
How much more luminous will it be at the end of an main sequence than a single star because of mixing?
Oh, this is a good question. Actually, I could not tell you for this because, but of course, you have the effect due to the mixing. A single star would have probably an evolution which would be at the beginning, if we take this one as it would be rotation at first, decrease the luminosity due to the hydrostatic effect, and then will increase it due to the. This would be a non rotating star. Schematically, I would say, but I don't know the. Okay. So now I would like to say a few words about the non-solid body rotation case. But sorry, I have to just come back to my note. So the point in case of non-solid body rotation is that you can no longer write the equation, you cannot longer write, I would say, a potential. So you have that, you have still the same equation for the hydrostatic equation. So rho gf, this remains the same, and you have exactly the same, if you make the Roche approximation, the same expression for the gravity, classical gravity, the same expression for the centrifugal acceleration. But in that case, you cannot write gradient of space is no longer equal to rho minus gradient of a potential. It's no longer the case. This is non-solid rotation. Actually, you remember that we had for the solid body rotating case the equation minus 1/2 r square omega square sin square theta. If you take the gradient of that, you will have a gradient of omega now, which will appear because omega is no longer constant. And it's why you cannot write this. You can write a little bit, you can use this expression to write the hydrostatic equation, but you have to make a correction in order to remove this term in gradient of omega, which does not appear in the hydrostatic equilibrium equation. So you can write, for instance, this is a way of doing, this is just mathematics, rho minus gradient of psi, and you have a term minus r square sin square theta, omega, gradient of omega. This is simply a term to remove the gradient of omega that we have introduced here, and which exists when omega is no longer constant. Now this equation is very interesting because you see that in case of cellular rotation, you have that omega is a function of the pressure, actually is constant along isobaric surfaces. It means that gradient of P is parallel to gradient of omega. But of course, in order to have this parallelism to be maintained, you need that this term is also parallel to the gradient of omega. So it means that psi equal constant are no longer equipotential, but they give you the shape of isobaric surfaces. So you have, if you make the Roche approximation, you can compute the shape of the isobaric surfaces, which are the same as the shape of the equipotential in the conservative case. Of course, in the conservative case, you have that rho is constant along isobaric surface because you have gradient of P, which is proportional to gradient of C, and so rho is a constant along this on an isobaric surface. We have what we call a barotropic model. In case of Schiele rotation, it's no longer the case. We have a baroclinicity. We have that surface of constant density are different from the surface of constant pressure. Okay. Anyway, the point is that you know the shape of this isobaric surface, and you can use now not a trick, but a method which has been devised a long time ago by Kipanen and Thomas, which allows you to write a structure equation in case of solid body rotation. The trick, the point of Kipanen and Thomas was to say, okay, we can replace the quantity which varies along an isobar, like for instance, the effective gravity. The effective gravity is varying along the isobar. It's not the same at the equator than at the pole. You can replace this by a proper average over the surface of an equipotential. And you can do the same for Schiele rotation, thanks to this property here. Actually, for instance, if I take the equation for the hydrostatic equilibrium, you can write dp over dmr is equal dmr 4 pi r squared in case of non-rotating model. In case of conservative model, or you can write it a little bit differently. You can see that it's like the surface of a sphere of radius r multiplied by j. Actually, what you will do is to compute the same type equation, but now you have dp over dmp, where mp is the mass enclosed into an isobaric surface. You could have also write mrp, where rp is such that the volume inside the isobaric surfaces is 4/3 prp to the cube, is equal to 1 divided by the surface of the isobaric surfaces, multiplied here by the effective gravity, minus 1, where this average here, minus 1, is equal to 1 over sp, and you have the integral of df minus 1 d sigma. So this is the way of doing. Actually, for instance, you will resolve the equation at a given specific point along on an isobaric surface, at the point where the radius is equal to rp. And you will obtain the temperature, the density at that point. In a conservative case, the density at that point will be also the density over the whole isobaric surface. In case of Schiele rotating models, density will vary along an isobaric surface.
So how much it will vary?
Okay. Actually, this is exactly the point where you have this kind of discussion, up to which point you can you can go with the rotating models. Actually, that specific point, the density as a function of the latitude, I have no numbers in my mind now. I can give you reference where you can show how the density varies along an isobaric surface, but I have not the numbers in my mind.
George, when you formulate, is there a minus 1 in the exponent? It looks like a minus 1, but it's funny.
Actually, it's the average. This is this one.
Yes.
Yes, it's the effective gravity with the exponent minus 1. It's 1 over there. Sorry.
So why do you use minus 1 just for clarification?
Oh, this is actually when you do the calculus to make this demonstration, actually what you get in this. But I have done it, but it's due to the way of computing this.
But this S is the ratio of the real surface over 4 pi r squared?
No, this is really the surface, you see. It will be the surface of this isobaric surfaces. So you have isobars. If it is not rotating, it will be the surface of a sphere, which is 4 pi r squared. And in case it is rotating, it is deformed. And it's why you need the Roche approximation to compute the shape of this surface. So here we have actually a set of stellar structure equations where you use a Roche approximation in order to compute the shape of these isobaric surfaces. Now, I would say that when you are doing with cellular rotation, there is a point where you may not be consistent. And this is what limits the rotation rate at which you can go with this kind of models. The point is that, if you remember, maybe it was a long time ago because it was my first presentation here, when we look at the equation for the transport of the angular momentum, with this equation with the diffusive part and the advective part. Actually, in this equation, what happens is omega bar. And omega bar, actually, you can write omega r as a function of r and theta as omega bar over r plus something which will depend on r and theta. This can be written as omega 2 r p2 cosinus theta, with p2 cosinus theta is a Legendre polynomial. So in the equation for the angular momentum transport, what happens in all the development made by Tsan is this omega bar. While in all these equations, what happens is omega p. And this is actually where some inconsistency can be bring, because what the cellular rotation rate tells you is that you have omega constant on isobars. But here, you are looking for the mean along a spherical surface. And, of course, there is nothing wrong of choosing one of these two, but in models, we identify these two quantities, you see. And this, of course, implies that we cannot do that if we are too much deformed. And the question is to know what we call too much deformed. In general, we take omega over omega crit 0.7 as the upper limit, because above that, you are more deformed than 10%. But of course, I cannot give you more quantitative value, because in order to do that, we should use more terms. This is we limited here to the second orders. There is no one orders because of symmetry with the equator. So you could go with a fourth order term, for instance. You can redo the whole computation, which is quite complicated for deriving the meridional currents and so on, and do again the whole computation. But this has never been done, you would say. Okay, so this is a point. So now, if we look at cellular rotation rate, and I come to the point that that you mentioned before, do we consider that the Roche model is still a good approximation? Because I spoke about the solid body rotating stars, and I said, okay, we start from critical limit at the border, and when we go inside, since omega remains constant, and the critical limit increases, we go away from the critical limit when we go inside. But if we have omega which vary as a function of depth, it may be that, of course, this is no longer true. It may be that in the center, we can reach some situation where omega becomes higher than the critical limit, because it can increase faster than omega crit. And thus, in that case, it will break down the Roche model approximation, because you will have a lot of mass which will be deformed. So is it the case? Actually, fortunately, it's in general not the case. If we look, for instance, at the 20 solar mass stars, and we put here, as a function of the mass, mr over m star, and we put here v over v crit. It's not omega over omega crit, because I didn't find in my plot that I had in my computer this kind. So we have the center here. We have the surface, 20 here. And actually, we have a curve which will be, we suppose these stars reach the critical limit in the middle of the main sequence, because we started from a relatively high initial rotation. And we have here the same mechanism as for the strong coupling, which is a little bit slower, in the sense that when you have a strong coupling, as I explained, you take angular momentum from the core to the surface, and it may make the star to reach the breakup limit. In case of Schellner rotation, you do the same, but in a less efficient way. Actually, the core will still rotate faster than the envelope by a factor 2 and 4. It depends, of course, on the situation. But there is, in general, a factor between 2 and 4 between omega of the core and omega of the envelope. But despite this, the V over V crit will be something like this, which is, again, so you have here 1. You have here a value which is 0.07. At 10 solar mass, half of the mass, you have 0.10. At 18, you have 0.2. And at 19, you have 0.40. And you see 0.2, it means omega over omega crit, 0.3. 0.14, it's a little bit more, 0.5. So it means that in that stars, very little mass is very strongly deformed. And so probably, I would say that we are relatively safe with this approximation, even if we are wrong at the surface. At the surface, of course, it's not correct. But for the gravitational potential, it has no effect because there is so little mass. But it may have an effect due to this coincidence here for the transport of the angular momentum.
And that's, of course, true for radiative stars. If you had a convective star, then the story would be different, but you don't really have that situation, I guess.
It's right. Actually, if you suppose that the convective zone would rotate as a solid body, you are a little bit like in the solid body case. Of course, in case you have a huge convective star, you will be probably in the red supergiant, where the velocity is very low anyway. So, it may be an issue, I would say. I don't know if some kind of binary evolution.
Dehydry, for example.
Okay. So in that case, Roche model could be a bad approximation, I would say. For single star, I looked also in the models for very, I would say, advanced stage of the evolution, and we are still very far, most of the mass for the critical limit. Okay. So now I would like to, I don't know if Catherine, you would like to speak how much time?
15 minutes.
15 minutes, and Stan?
It's okay.
It's okay, because I don't want to monopolize. Actually, I am more or less here, and I would like to speak about chemical mixing, if it is okay. Okay, so actually, this kind of situation here shows you that why the hydrostatic effects of rotation are most of the time very small. In that model, for instance, the kinetic energy in the rotation, which will be one half the moment of inertia omega square, is about 1% of the gravitational energy. It means that if the only effect of rotation will be the deformation of the star, actually it will be a very, very second order effect, if not a fourth order effect, you see. What makes a difference is the mixing of the chemical elements. This is the key point to know how much mixing is induced by rotation. And this is just a point I would like to discuss a little bit here. So actually, if we look at the equation for the transport of the chemical mixing, we have a... So I have... We have an equation which will be of the type, so rho, derivative of the mass fraction of an element with respect to time. I look only at the rotational mixing here. I don't speak about the change due to the nuclear reaction for simplicity, but we can write the other term. We would have 1 over r square, derivative with respect to r, and rho r square, and you have 2 diffusion coefficients that I write like this here, derivative with x e with respect to r. Here I account for 2 diffusion coefficients. One is the shear diffusion coefficient. And the one here is what we call effective diffusion coefficient. Of course, you could add some diffusion coefficient due to some magnetic instability, for instance. But let us look at that at the moment. The point I would like to mention is that most of the models that are published today can be more or less divided in 2 big families, in my view. Maybe it's a little bit schematic, but at least it's a good way to remind the things. Actually, you have the models in which you have weak coupling. By weak coupling, I mean that when the core contract and the envelope extend, you will have some transport of angular momentum from the core to the envelope, but not such a way to produce solid body rotation. This is what I call weak coupling. Weak coupling means differential rotation during the main sequence. And strong coupling would be the case, for instance, if you have a very efficient meridional current, or you have a magnetic field which will impose solid body rotation, typically solid body rotation, Taylor-Spreut dynamo, for instance, are this kind of models. So in the weak coupling, the main term for the mixing of chemical element is DS, the shear diffusion coefficient. In the strong coupling, the main term for mixing elements is actually this DE. Actually, of course, this would be the case in our Geneva way of doing the things, but more or less I would say it's probably the same, because if you put magnetic field, you have a diffusion coefficient which will vary as the meridional current, more or less, and this varies as omega squared in a very schematic way. Instead, here it varies as d omega over dr, to the square, by the way. So here you have two kinds of mixing, which produce very different evolution, actually. And there are many differences. I would like not to discuss in detail the equation, the different, I would say, results in a quantitative way, but I would like just to mention them in a qualitative way. There is first a big difference between the strong and the weak coupling. It is the quantity of angular momentum in the core at the end of the evolution. Because, of course, if you have a strong coupling, you will remove much more angular momentum from the core, because you put it in the envelope, and in the envelope it can be thrown away by the mass loss, for instance. So the rotation rate at the end of the evolution in the core of the star, the principal end of the stage, will be different, probably in both cases. But it depends, of course, on the metallicity, on the mass loss rate. Strong coupling, you have slower rotating core. Weak coupling, you have faster rotating core. Yes?
So if you have coupling from, like, G-modes and things like that, where do they fit into this?
Okay. So this is actually what I am used to is the difference between Taylor-Spreut dynamo and non-magnetic models. For what concerns the transport of angular momentum by the gravity waves, of course, I know that, for instance, Corinne Charbonnen and Susan Talon say that it can reproduce the solid body rotating in the sun. Actually, magnetic field can do also the same. But I know less, much less about that point, so I would not say something very accurate here. Yeah.
I may be wrong, but my understanding from what you was that even the strong coupling is not strong enough to explain operation.
Yeah. Apparently, that appears to be the case. Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, just to give you an idea, so this this diffusion coefficient in a 20 solar mass star is between 10 to the 8, 10 to the 10 centimeters square per gram. If I put here as a function of mr over m solar, it's for typically 20 solar mass stars. You have here a convective core. But in the relative envelope, the day shear will be something like this. This would be log d in centimeter square per second. And typically, you have here value of 8, here value of 10. It is increasing in the outer layers because the shear diffusion coefficient depends on the relative diffusive coefficient, which is increasing toward the exterior in the massive stars. This would be d shear. Actually, you can see that it is very small near the core. And this is essentially due to the mu gradient, because, of course, the core produces some, at least, in the border of the core, you have some mu gradient which appear, and this decrease actually the shear diffusion coefficient. And the DF will be something like this. It's much smaller, except near the core here. I forgot to mention that this DF contains actually the interaction between two instabilities, the meridional currents and the strong horizontal turbulence. But I will not so much enter into this detail at the moment. In case of a strong coupling, actually, if we look at such a diagram, we will have a situation where D shear is very small because, of course, you have no gradient or nearly no gradient, so the D shear disappears. And most of the mixing is due to the DE, which will be something like this, and which can take a value similar to that one, to the D shear, even stronger. So one of the big difference is the quantity of angular momentum at the end of the evolution. Another big difference is the fact that if you start from a given initial mass, a given initial metallicity, a given angular momentum content at the beginning, the model with a strong coupling will be more mixed than the model with a weak coupling.
The D effective in the strong, is that the 10 to the 8 value or the 10 to the 10 value?
Oh, sorry, the DF here it's about 6.5, and here it's a little bit higher, but anyway, it is blurred by the D shear effect. So where it is important, it is about 6.5 in this model of 20 solar mass stars.
And then in the strong coupling, the value is?
This, of course, this what was at the end of the main sequence, if I remember well, 0.20. And the plot I found here is for the beginning of the main sequence, 0.60. And it was around 7. But it does not mean, actually, this model will be more mixed than this one. Because when you go along the evolution, the DE will increase a little bit. And so it will more mix. It will mix more efficiently, this model. So the strong coupling model are more mixed at a given age than the weak mixing model. It implies also that the condition for reaching homogeneous evolution will be easier when you have strong coupling. Typically, I have compared, for instance, a model for a 60 solar mass star for the metallicity of 1/3/18. Sechis, I think, has made a very interesting work on that, computing grids with strong coupling. And actually, typically, they find that if they start with a velocity of 340 kilometers per second on the SAMs, they follow a homogeneous evolution. If we do the same with a weak coupling with a cellular rotation rate, non-solid body rotation, even at 430 kilometers per second, we have a classical track. We have no longer homogeneous evolution. So it shows you a little bit how it can be different depending you have a weak or a strong coupling. Yes?
Is it possible to, write down, just given symmetry constraints on the dependence of the diffusion coefficient on omega and its derivatives, a general expansion, and then say it's got some coefficients that could be varied and can compare with
obstacles? So, sorry, I don't get to your point.
Well, so it looks like you've essentially said the diffusion coefficient is something multiplied by omega squared plus something multiplied by d omega dr squared.
Of course, it is quite schematic here. Yeah.
Sure. But there are probably symmetry constraints based on the fact that you can't unmix on how the diffusion coefficient can depend on omega and its derivatives.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if you could just write down a generic expression, include both effects, and then constrain those coefficients.
Actually, I can just explain you how the D shear is obtained, maybe. I will do that now, if I still have some time.
To give a counterexample to that, if you think that gravity waves transport an interesting amount of angular momentum, then a very key feature of that is shear, absorption by shear layers. And in that case, the exact profile of omega is super important. And just having something that scales like omega squared or omega, that's not going to work at all.
Okay.
I'm not sure that
that's different. That might be different for the diffusion species mixing. I think that's true for angular momentum, but I'm not sure that you couldn't do that for diffusion, right?
But if you have breaking waves, locally at a given value of omega.
Well, this would incorporate that, right? Because omega squared is a function of r or p, and right. So
it's not that straightforward. DE is solved to this initial speed circulation based on the angular velocity profile. But what you say, that's where you can find probably even in the case of a low angular velocity, that probably will be approximately look like that. But for a fast rotation, it maybe even disappear.
Sure.
Maybe just before to go to the point how we can obtain this here, just a third difference here, which is interesting to mention, is the reaction of this model to a surface breaking. Actually, you can have a surface breaking due to disk locking, for instance, during the formation phase. You can have it due to a wind magnetic breaking, if there is a strong wind and a strong magnetic field, as has been studied by Hudula and Stan Wookie. You can have also a breaking in case you have not synchronicity in a closed binary system at the beginning. Actually, what you will obtain here is that in case of a weak coupling, actually you will, of course, in both cases, break down the star. So the surface velocity will go down. But in that case, you will boost the mixing because you increase the shear in the surface layers. In that case, you will damp the mixing because you reduce omega in the whole star. So typically, for instance, if you have a kind of diagram V sinus I, and you put here the surface of N over H at the surface of a star, or let us put V because we are doing theorem, we don't need the sinus I. So I would say that if I plot in such a diagram the weak coupling, of course, during the main sequence, the equatorial velocity changes a little bit, but not so much. And then it goes the red giants, where the surface velocity decreases a lot. And you have some degrees of enhancement. The same models with strong coupling will go much higher because, as I said, it makes more mixing. But you have the same behavior. Now, if you break down the model here, you will have such kind of evolution. You will decrease the surface velocity, but you increase the surface enrichment because you increase the gradient of omega, the surface layer. If you do the same for the models with strong coupling, you will do something, I would say, something like this. You will have a very little mixing because it takes time, and the time scale for the breaking here is shorter than the time scale for the mixing. So you actually, you kill the mixing in that models. Of course, this is just differences. Of course. Now, what is the best?
You talk about 10 times increase in nitrogen?
Sorry?
Just roughly speaking.
Roughly speaking, exactly it can be a few times, yes. 8, 6, yeah. I don't know.
And the lower one, with the weak coupling, would be?
This one?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't remember all the numbers by heart. It can be a factor 2, yes. Factor. But I must say, I have not all the numbers in my mind. Sorry for that. Now, what I wanted to say. Ah, yes. It is about how we obtain this shear. Actually, for the shear criterion, or for the shear diffusion, you need some criterion to be fulfilled. Actually, there are two of them. There is what we call the Richardson criterion. And let us just say a few words about this criterion. Actually, in the book by Chandrasekhar in 1961, there is a very nice and very simple way of looking at this Richardson criterion. You see, you have typically, let us consider inside a star, so we go up in the star, so the gravity will be in that way. And you have a blob with some velocity, v, and here a blob with some velocity, let us say v plus dv. Dv can be negative, of course, whatever, it's not a problem. And actually, the point is, if you wait some time due to the friction between the due to the differential rotation, you will end with a situation after some times where here the velocity would be v plus 1/2 dv, and here the velocity will be again v plus 1/2 dv. And you can compute the work which is necessary to make this exchange. Of course, here you are in the relative layers. So in the relative layer, it is stable. So you have to take this material and to go against the stable density gradient, and also for this one. So the work which is needed, you can write, I will not do the development, but it's easy to do, it will be J delta rho delta z, where delta rho is equal to the derivative of the interior of the cell divided by z minus the derivative of the exterior of the cell divided by z, with respect to z, delta z. You can also compute the difference of kinetic energy between the two situations. In the first, you have 1/2 rho v squared plus 1/2 rho at the position z plus dz, v plus dv to the square, minus the equivalent, I would say, expression when you have uniform rotation. And you can compute the difference between the kinetic energy between these two states. And delta k will be 1/4 rho delta v to the square. Actually, when you go from, you can see like this, like a decay to a, you have the excited state here, the non-excited state here, and when you decay, you can have this energy that you can use in order to overcome the density gradient. So actually, in order for this mixing to occur, you need that the energy that you have available be greater than the energy that is needed to do the mixing. And this is the physics of the Richardson criterion. Okay. Actually, this is a very, I would say, key point for the mixing of the elements by the shear. You can, of course, write it in a different way. You have the Richardson number that is defined as g over rho, where you have derivative of dz delta rho divided by dv over dz to the square, which should be below the critical Richardson criterion that is taken equal to 1/4, sorry, the 1/4 coming from here. This is just a reshuffling of the elements, a little bit of calculus, but this is the way to write the Richardson criterion. The 1/4 here, it has been tested by some numerical simulation. I know that Bruggen and Hillebrand has found more value around 1. Canuto also in 2002 has more value around 1. But anyway, this is of order unity, I would say. And you can see that in order for this to be satisfied, to have the mixing, this term should be great enough. You need to have a gradient above some limits. Otherwise, it will not work. It will cancel the turbulence.
How do you calculate the delta rho?
Sorry?
How do you calculate
I see. The delta rho, actually, you can change it by using the equation of state. I will write it. You suppose it's a little bit like in the theory of convection. Exactly. So you can write g delta divided by hp, nabla I minus nabla E, where nabla I is the interior gradient, nabla E is the exterior gradient, plus phi over delta, and here you have the exterior gradient in mu gradient, divided by dv over dz to the square, which would be inferior to this critical Richardson criterion.
The ratio of Brownian Bessel frequency to shear.
Absolutely, yes, exactly. Now, of course, what is nabla I, what is nabla E? Because actually it happens that the velocity of this instability is relatively small. It's so small that during the movement, the cell has time to radiate away its energy. So it means that nabla I will not be equal to nabla ad in any way, actually. And what would be nabla E? Nabla E probably would be very near nabla rad. Actually, it's possible to use expression like this. I would say nabla E minus nabla A can be written in a very, I would say, general way. It can be written as a number which is a Peclet numbers divided by PE plus 1, nabla ad minus nabla E, where the Peclet number, actually it's not exactly the Peclet number as it is defined, but it depends on the typical velocity of the instability, typical length over which instability developed, divided by 6k, where k is the radiative coefficient, which is 4ACT cubed divided by 3kp rho square Cp, if I remember well. Okay, so you can see that if this is a kind of diffusion coefficient, if the diffusion coefficient due to this shear mixing is small with respect to the relative diffusion coefficient, it means that Pe is very small, it's much smaller than 1. And this means that this process will transport very little energy. It's a little bit like a pot which is used to transport water from a given A to another one, but this pot has a hole. So the water is flowing away, and so it's very inefficient to transport energy, you see? And it means that, for instance, Pe divided by Po plus 1 is about Pe, typically. So you see that nabla I is not equal to nabla ad. It's nabla ad, this difference is nabla ad minus nabla e, but a much smaller value. Actually, on the other hand, you can also find a relation between nabla e and nabla ad and nabla rad. You can write nabla rad plus 6 Pe square divided by 1 plus Pe nabla ad divided by 6 Pe square 1 plus Pe. And this is about...
I think it's the table for this is important to know.
Sorry?
This
is Colping. You...
Colping.
It's all right.
It's all right.
Colping depth.
There is an optical depth, yes. 5 minutes. It's okay? It's okay for Catherine. I have still 5 minutes. Okay. So actually, if you do this, actually you can see that nabla A will be near, if you have a very small Peclet number, which is the case actually, you will have that nabla E is about nabla rad. You can replace nabla A minus nabla A by Pe nabla ad minus nabla rad. If you do that, you can rewrite the Richardson criterion, and actually you have a situation where you have VL over K multiplied by nabla ad minus nabla rad should be inferior to the Richardson criterion critique, dv over dz to the square minus g phi over hp nabla mu, which is the extended one. And actually, this is the way to obtain the shear diffusion coefficient, and this is the point where I want to go. It's because, you see, the shear diffusion coefficient will be something like 1/3 VL. Now, if you have turbulence, it is the largest headies which will mainly transport, make the transport. So you can choose different value of L. You start with very high value, and you decrease it until you have the Richardson criterion which is satisfied. So you can find the L where you have this egality, the first L, and you put it here, and you have the diffusion coefficient. And this is how the déchirure is obtained. Now, you can see that. So you will have something like déchirure will be, in that case, something like 2k, so it depends on the relative diffusion coefficient. You will have this difference here, to take some a, divided by j delta over hp nabla ad minus nabla rad. And you can see a point which is very important here. You can see that if the mu gradient is very great, it cancels the mixing because it becomes negative. So you have here an illustration of the strong inhibiting effect of the mu gradient. Yes?
So I want to come back to these numbers, actually.
Yes.
That's really my question.
Yes, I know. Because, well, since you're here, I think we should, I would like to discuss this now because, so the couple of, I think there's two? How many? Two?
Two B stars.
Two B stars.
Or three F stars.
They can actually put some measures on this value, and it's orders of magnitude lower than these numbers.
Okay.
And I don't, as my theorist mind thinks, those are reasonable numbers. I don't have any clue how the observations are now showing these numbers to be 100 or 10 centimeters squared per second. So what do we do?
Okay, this is a good point.
And I think this is something we should, we have to acknowledge those observational inferences exist and figure out what this means.
But I don't understand how you can observe diffusion coefficient.
That's my lecture of tomorrow.
But I will be away. I have to leave tomorrow.
Basically,
I will send you two references.
Okay, okay.
You can read them on the fly.
I see.
But basically, they have dips in their in the G modes that would be washed out if their mixing was a certain for a given mixing. But since they see them, that means the mixing can't be that big, and so they put a limit.
Rather than rotating like this,
they're
slow rotating.
This is a fast rotating star.
Well, one is 25% critical. Sure. The other one is
depends on the differential rotation.
Yeah,
right?
So
it depends on how well you also know differential rotation.
We know that.
But DE doesn't so much.
He doesn't, yes.
Less.
Actually, I won't take too much time now. I will just to finish the point here by saying the following point. When we did our first rotating models in 97, we put this kind of expression for the Deschamps on. Actually, if we do that and we apply strictly this Richardson criterion, it kills the mixing. You can rotate very fast, there is no mixing. Because every time you have a mu gradient, the Richardson criterion is no longer satisfied. And the few years after, Tailon and Tsan proposed something different. Actually, you see, in the same spirit as this equation, which show the effect of the transport on the gradient of the temperature, you can write a similar equation for the mu gradient, because in all these when we replace delta rho by this equation, we suppose that the mu inside the cell is not changed. But if you have a strong horizontal turbulence, it's not the case. When the cell is going up, the strong horizontal turbulence will mix with the leaven in some way. So the mu will change inside the cell. And we account for that. You have a different expression for the Deschamps, which allows some mixing. But this is an illustration of how mu gradient has to be treated with care and are a key point to switch on or switch off the mixing. And I stop here because...
So, Connie, you only have rotation rate on the surface, so you also have rotation rate inside the star?
Inside the star, yeah. We're doing G-modes. It's in the near core region.
So, what's the rotation rate in the near core region? 25% of critical?
Mm-hmm. For one star. We only have two B stars, let that be clear. But the same effect should be for the F stars. They have a convective core, which is well developed. And there we have 40 stars.
George, those numbers you quoted were for a 20 solar mass star?
Yes.
Yeah,
how much will they change if you go to the 3 solar mass star?
Not four orders of magnitude.
Not four?
No. Of course it depends. Actually, for the 3, I have not so much numbers because we are always computing.
I know. I keep telling you to go to slower rotators and lower masses. Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to talk about two-dimensional rotation, modeling all of the stuff that Jean-Jean's just been talking about, but in two dimensions. And the big problem here, if you want to actually try and model the star and the rotation and be completely consistent and not have to worry about things like the Roche approximation, your big problem is that it's a two-dimensional problem, and so you can't use the mass as an independent variable anymore, because then you would have to try and integrate it over angles, and it just doesn't make any sense. So I use a particular rotation code, and what we've done is instead of using mass, we use the fractional radius as our independent variable. We have fractional radius and co-latitude, of course, as our independent variables. This doesn't do anything nice to the equations, let me tell you. Mass conservation, for example, you're all used to seeing this nice form. That turns into
this mass. And that's the simplest one. So, as you can imagine, this complicates your calculation a little bit. So the variables all have sort of their usual definitions. We have the potential for motion in all three directions. This one, this capital V, is a coordinate system flow. So if you have a star that's expanding or contracting, that's not zero. So you have motion in all directions. The V theta, though, the motion from the pole to the equator, is usually constrained. You want there to be symmetry around the pole and at the equator, then that has to be zero.
Isn't that part of the thing that rotation does is also drive meridional flows. So isn't it strange to have V theta equal zero to get 2D? Part of the reason you want to do 2D is so that you get that self-consistently, so...
But the meridional circulation happens on a much slower time scale than the evolution, so...
Faster times, yes.
A much smaller time scale is what I'm thinking. So there has been some effort to put it into this code, but it's turning out to be very tricky just because of the differences in time scale.
So we should regard these as time averaged equations?
Now, you still have to do something with the surface. So what you end up with these two coordinate variables, is you have a grid that is, despite how I've drawn it, spherical. So you have a whole bunch of zones in R and theta, and then you define the surface to be an equipotential, the same as with the one-dimensional codes. So now your surface looks something like this when you have a rapidly rotating star. So the better angular resolution you have, the better your surface is going to be defined. Unfortunately, the more better angular resolution you have, the more zones you have to calculate and the longer the calculation takes. So there's some trade-offs to be had there. The way we determine the equipotential is we define it to be whatever the radius is at the surface. So you find this equipotential, and then find whatever radial zone has the value closest to that.
Why you can't stay on? It will be natural to stay on the equipotential zone.
Sorry?
Why you have to put the grid on spherical? I mean, why initially you have to write the equation this way, not the equipotential?
This is the way it was done. I didn't write the code. I know some of the decisions about how the code was set up initially were to allow hydrodynamic simulations as well. So this code will actually run hydro. You can set it up to run an evolution sequence, or you can set it up to run hydro. And some of the decisions about how to set up the equations and how to set up the grid were made because of the hydro side of things.
But won't we get more shocks between the cells if they're not on the same equipotential?
Well, no, they are. They are on the same. This and this are the same equipotential.
No, but when you calculate between the cells, when you solve your grid, how do you solve your grid?
It's a Henle inversion.
Yeah, but then the adjusting points this way everywhere in star will have different
And I think that's why you end up with this. For symmetry, you have to constrain the theta velocities. So that's the basics of how we do it. And actually, mostly, it turns out I'm going to be talking about the effects of rotation at the surface when you model things in two dimensions. When you include all of these effects, you start to see things behave a little bit differently. You start to find the Roche approximation works to fairly high rotations, but at the highest rotation rates, of course, it doesn't. You get slight differences in the surface, and that produces other effects. So you have things like von Zeipel's law. And we found that that tends to overpredict the variation in surface temperature. So when you have this deformation, as we've talked about already, you end up with a pole that is much hotter than the equator. So you end up with something like this from von Zeipel. And in two dimensions, you end up with something that's a little bit flatter.
And wouldn't it be even more flat if V theta was not forced to be zero?
Probably.
I mean, I'm just asking. That's what it would. That's what that would do in my mind. But in my mind, something. So. Does anybody have any?
I don't have any immediate thoughts. Sorry.
The physical reason for that, why the 2D gives a big difference, is because of difference of distribution of mass inside the star?
A little bit, yes. Yeah, the shape of the surface is slightly different. And of course, if you have a difference in temperature, that affects a whole bunch of other things, like you were talking about the interferometric observations of stars. There's a paper by Gillick et al. That looked at this, and it's 2007, I think. And they did a whole bunch of models. They did evolution models. And then they did atmospheric models on top of that to get what the gravity darkening should look like. And they found at the highest rotation rates that the star as a function of inclination could vary by 3 or 4 solar masses compared to just straight fitting in the HR diagram. And I think there may have been a follow-up paper. I know there was an attempt at least to get like a scaling relation that you could use to take a 1D model and figure out how long that line should be.
Can I ask, I mean, what would be the difference? I mean, it doesn't have to be an exact number, but just to get a feeling for the difference at temperature between the 1 and the 2D.
Percent difference.
Say at a critical velocity of 70.
I don't remember the numbers, I'm sorry.
Is it bigger or smaller than the difference between the pole and the equator? No idea.
Bigger, I think.
Well, von Zeipel in 1D has a difference between the pole and the equator.
Yes.
On the way you plot it, it's weaker, right?
So in two dimensions, it's weaker, yes.
Yeah.
But he's saying, is the difference between the two, the von Zeipel and 2D, greater or less than the difference between pole and equator?
Yes, right.
Oh, okay. No, it's smaller.
It's smaller. Okay.
Yeah, so this difference...
The effect is still there.
Yeah, the effect is still there. It's just slightly smaller effect.
So often it's written as T effective goes like G effective to the 1/4 power for von Zeipel. So the observations will often constrain that exponent. Instead of being 1/4, it might be 0.2 or 0.8. Could you give us a handle on maybe what your 2D models give?
This is something I started to look at and then dropped.
Okay, well maybe we can talk about it.
Yeah. But I did start to look at it, and I don't remember what the number is.
Yeah, that value of beta seems to change from star to star.
Right,
yeah.
But the observations typically show something in the upper teens. Like
yeah, I think it was around
0.18 or
0.2.
0.18 to 0.2, where
yeah.
Rosego gives you 0.25.
Yeah.
How does this compare with other 2D models like the Aster group population?
Mm-hmm. Aster.
Aster. I'm not sure they've done much as far as direct comparisons, and I haven't either. The last I saw, the big difference was they still can't do evolution.
Right.
They only do structure.
That's why I think it would be interesting to compare.
I think it gives also smoother,
flatter.
Oh, they also get that.
They get the right. And
That might in our case, though, be because of the V theta, right? We don't know. I mean, and it might be hard for them to and that might be a good way reason to compare to see what's due to this and what. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, do you know if that V theta equals zero applies to the hydrodynamic mode in this rotor code? I thought that you could get. Flows
yes.
In every direction if you put it in hydro mode.
In hydro mode, you definitely can.
So you could maybe compare directly then with this other code. Hydro mode, this is the evolution mode where
yes.
You have this constraint.
So the other thing I've looked at is mass loss. What happens to the mass loss if you have a temperature variation that isn't predicted by one, or that is different from that predicted by sort of 1D approximations? You might expect the mass loss rates to be different as well. And I found they are. They're not the same as those in the one-dimensional models. So if you look at m dot as a function of rotation rate, I've put it in velocity, there's a 1D scaling that shows that the mass loss rate increases as. So for different masses, you have an increase in mass loss as the rotation rate increases. And in zero-age main sequence models, at least, which is all I've done this for, you get things that go in the other direction. So the mass loss rate actually decreases as the rotation rate increases.
How do you calculate the mass loss rate in your models?
So zone by zone, at the surface, I calculate how much mass should be lost. From this particular zone based on the local effective temperature and the local flux. And I've done it for standard CAK mass loss rates as well as Yorick's 2000-2001 models. They get the same sort of qualitative results. And then what I found, I looked at sort of why this happens. And you get a lot of variation from pole to equator in how much mass is lost as well. So the two-dimensional models lose more mass from the pole than they do from the equator. So the mass loss rates look something like that as a function of collatitude.
Well, that's a bit strange because the main reason for the difference between pole and equator and mass loss is because of the higher flux, the fact that the pole is brighter. But now you're saying that when you go to 2D, you actually get a stronger mass, the contrast between the pole and the equator.
Yes.
I don't quite understand that, but we can talk about it offline.
We also, with 2D radiation-driven wind models, we found a decrease in the mass rate of the rotation.
Decreasing the what?
Oh. Decreasing m dot.
Okay. So that's not completely.
We're not, I think, 2014. And it's probably a similar effect.
Yeah. And the other thing I found is that this, of course, affects the angular momentum loss from the star because you're losing more mass where there's no angular momentum and less mass where there is lots of angular momentum. And so compared to 1D models, the two-dimensional models that are losing mass lose mass more slowly. And so presumably they'll spin down more slowly, and that's going to have all kinds of other effects for subsequent evolution.
What's the pole equator contrast in your
depth?
Depends on how rapidly it rotates.
Yeah, it depends on the rotation rate. I didn't write down the difference between pole and equator, but I did find that this difference is 1.2 to 2.5 times at the pole.
Is this dm dot d theta or dm dot d surface area or what?
Just total for each angular zone. So yeah, per theta.
Per solid angle.
Yeah. This is all from the point of view of stellar evolution, so I'm not worried at all about where the mass is going. This is just how much mass did I have to take out of this zone.
But what I mean is that if your zones aren't all the same in theta, right, then you could have larger
it
and not just because larger.
They are all the same size in theta. So.
Okay.
I'm having trouble understanding this difference because you find compared to von Zeipel, the 2D has a smaller difference in temperature from pole to equator. But the mass loss rate difference is bigger.
That's what I was asking.
So what is driving that?
There's also the radius effects as well. It's not a Roche potential anymore.
The point is the mass loss rate depends also on the effective temperature.
Yeah, the mass loss rates depend on the flux, the temperature.
But the temperature goes the other way.
Right. But it's a combination of all of the effects that matter.
So this is for which kind of stars? Because if you have a massive stars, which is...
It can depend on the stellar parameters, on the HX. The mass loss rate is a complicated function of luminosity, mass, effective temperature. So it depends a bit on where you are in that plane as to whether the mass loss rate would go up with rotation or whether it could go down with rotation. That effect is actually more important than the other effects.
I did this for 20, 40, and I think 60 solar mass stars, but only zero-age main sequence so far, like I said.
But yeah, when I see plots like this, mass loss as a function of latitude, then I always get headaches because what I imagine is what must happen is that if you, say, get higher masses from the pole than from the equator, you must launch very strong flows, which fill the hole in the pole for matter from the equator, and if it starts rotating, you get, it can't be because there is angular momentum conservation constraints and so on. So you have the potential to investigate such flows.
Yes, I have not yet. As I say, this is really only for zero-age main sequence models. I haven't actually gotten into the evolution, so I haven't worried about what happens to the star after you take all this mass off.
But if you're only doing a short, not doing much evolution, then you could put the V theta in.
I could, yes.
And then that's an interesting problem in and of itself. At what rate, if you lose mass like that, at what rate does the flows and the dynamics inside adjust? Right.
That's actually a really good idea. That's not something I've looked at. I was trying to get this working in evolution, which is why I left the V thetas off.
This is the problem. You're trying to satisfy evolution people and dynamics people, and you're like, not doing it yet.
I'm sorry. The symmetry criterion, you must mean that you're not following V theta at all. You're assuming zero everywhere?
Because the
symmetry criterion doesn't eliminate the possibility of meridional flows. In fact, it's required by the geometry. The pole must be, right? It's a reflecting boundary.
Yeah.
Also, you probably don't have much meridional circulation across the equator either.
Right. Right. That one's less required.
So that's fine.
If you did two quadrants, you could allow that to be relaxed. But this does not eliminate the possibility of having these.
No, it doesn't. You're right.
I feel like the way you tackle this problem is, you have an iterator mode, so you start removing mass, and dependent, you understand how the flow occur, and then you write a new set of equation that you import into the evolution mode, then you see the long-term effect.
But
that.
Do you have the Coriolis force in there? Because if you don't, then it doesn't work.
I think you can. I'm not sure if it's on.
Whether you have, right?
I can't remember now whether it's on or not. It's been a long time since I've done these calculations.
When I first tried to develop models for oblate stars, for mass loss of oblate stars, it did a similar thing
where you have what we call this a stair casing, because you have to, in order to fit an oblate star on a spherical grid, you have four grids. And dynamically, it's very difficult to do the lateral motion from that, because you'll get all these little discontinuities that will occur at every one of the staircases. I mean, one of the things to point out is that a bunch of little stairs, even if the steps are really small, do not approximate properly a smooth curve. If you were in New York City and you go one block north, one block south, one block north, you still go the same as if you went 10 blocks north and 10 blocks south.
Yeah.
Compared to what you would do along a diagonal. So in other words, the stair casing is a real severe problem in hydro, in my experience, to get proper meridional flow. And so that's just a comment from my own experience. When we first tried to do oblate mass loss, you know, using a hydro code with radiation driving,
I can well believe that's a problem.
Use some polynomials or something, yeah.
Yeah.
Other models doesn't use these. Esther uses.
The good news here is that for this problem, you probably just want to look at the shell close to the surface, so you can increase the resolution there quite a lot.
Yeah, like I say, no matter how small a resolution you get, you have stuff going this way or that way, not
diagonal. The flow is much larger than the jump.
I've done a resolution study in that, and it doesn't really help you very much, because you always, the boundary conditions are always dealing with stuff that's either radial
I think this is a highly technical.
When this code has been used for hydro in the past, I know it's been used for looking at the convective core, which is far enough away from the boundary that it doesn't matter.
Do you have a reference for this code and who's used it for things?
Yeah, it's Dupree.
The name, does the code have a name?
It's called Rotork.
Rotork, okay.
And it's between 1990 and 1995 are the main. It was written almost 30 years ago now. It definitely does have its limitations. One of my dreams someday is to rewrite it so that it has higher resolution and comes up with a better surface treatment and conclude all these wonderful things that.
Well, a lot of these kinds of issues that Stan is talking about, are tied into how you do the differencing and what kind of high order reconstruction you do, if you do any at all, and that could get very high deep into the weeds.
Might sound like a technical detail, but
it's more important. No, I'm not meaning to minimize its importance. Believe me, I'm all about technical details. But, I'm just thinking about the overall conversation.
It's also much more challenging to run an evolution sequence. A single evolution sequence takes a few hours instead of 20 minutes. So, especially for the kind of things that people are doing now, you need large grids of models.
6 months.
I know it's small, I've done other big simulations, but compared to, say, MESA, it's much harder to make a big grid of models. You can have, the maximum is 600 radial zones and 20 angular zones. Which is not that great.
So it's not parallel then.
And it's because of the Henye inversion, the matrix solver, you can't easily parallelize it. At least that's what I've been told.
No, that's bullshit. Sorry, maybe you were told wrong. So it
has been proved since then.
But it may not be trivial.
Yeah.
But it's certainly possible.
Yeah, because parallelizing would be fantastic.
This is for solid body rotation or?
So it does, all of the models I've run are initially solid body. The code currently does not have angular momentum transport, which is another thing I would love to add in someday. But what it does is it conserves angular momentum locally. So the angular momentum profile still evolves. The core ends up rotating more rapidly. It can also include differential rotation. But in your equation where you had the potential was... I wrote this down. But you had a grad rho stuff, or grad omega. What we do is we will only consider cylindrical rotation laws. And then when you have a cylindrical rotation law, the gradient of omega is still conservative, and so you can still define an equipotential and everything behaves. That's all I have.
What kind of physical questions? try to answer this. It's too. Oh, what's on the agenda?
Well, someday I'm going to get this working for evolution. I also have a similar code, or not a similar code, a two-dimensional stellar pulsation code as well, so you can calculate pulsation frequencies, including the Coriolis force. So I've been looking at a lot of astroseismology of rapidly rotating stars. It's sort of been my main focus. The code is also set up to do stuff with binaries, although I haven't done much with that myself.